All right, guys, we are back. The Inside the Cross Division 3 podcast is back, and the NESCAC is back, and the Centennial Conference is back, and the Liberty League is back. Division 3 lacrosse is officially back. This is an exciting day. It was 364 days since the NESCAC announced that they were shutting down the spring 2020 season, that they came back and announced that there is going to be limited competition for this spring. There's obviously still a ton of questions, but Kyle and Dan, let's talk about our initial reactions to this news. Kyle, you are more in the heart of the NESCAC up there in the north. What is your take from this big announcement?
I think it's really exciting. I think we were kind of working on a top 20, and then we were like, so Tufts goes one, right? You know? And my reaction was absolutely yes, right away. I think that's the team to watch. I think there's some other exciting programs that are now going to be in our lives once again, which I'm very excited for. I think we're going to have to wait to see exactly which ones they are. I don't want to super speculate, but, you know, Tufts is the one I'm looking forward to the most. Obviously, Williams, and then, you know, hopefully Wesleyan as well.
Dan, what's your take?
I'm excited. You know, it's something that we have been processing and waiting for a long time. I think a lot of people were pessimistic, and so when the announcement was made, it was a good twist, and you know, there were a lot of people that were pleasantly surprised, which is, you know, this time last year we were very much so the opposite. So I'm happy they're back.
Yeah, it's really interesting, and pleasantly surprised is such a good way to put it, because, you know, several people that I talked to were really kind of shocked by this, and it seemed to develop a lot quicker than I would have imagined. You know, I got a text early in the day that, like, hey, there's, you know, some surprise meetings being called in the NESCAC. You know, maybe it's, you know, a decision on the spring. And then, you know, next thing you know, it's like, oh my gosh, we're going to have a spring. And I feel like some of the coaches were a little taken off guard, at least, you know, they were holding out hope this whole time. But just the fact that it happened, and it kind of happened pretty quickly, was a little surprising. You know, it's not all great news. You know, I don't want to get like too high with this, because not every team is going to play. You know, I think we've, you know, heard various level of speculation about a handful of the teams that might not play, whether it's due to enrollment issues or just kind of local restrictions that are more pertinent, you know, to them and their campus. And we're not necessarily sure all the details. It's going to be mid-April that they're going to start. We know that much, but, you know, it sounds like there's a plan for a NESCAC championship. Out of conference scheduling, you know, I don't think there's anything definitive on that yet. So that's a little bit wait and see. And this announcement opens the door for NCAA tournament play, but I don't think it necessarily completely 100% affirms that these teams are going to play in the NCAA tournament. So obviously that is a huge piece to this puzzle, because if there's an NCAA champion crowned and Tufts, for instance, is not a part of that tournament, that's an asterisk on this whole Division III season. So things still need to trend well. You know, test results, you know, can't keep going up. COVID cases can't keep going up. These student athletes are going to have to be diligent and have to be, you know, on the ball, or else it's going to put the whole league at risk. And then just nationally, you know, things have got to stay kind of on the straight and narrow here in order to get, you know, everything we want to see out of the NESCAC. But like, it is worth celebrating for a day, like in a speed, like I said, it's been 364 days. The NESCAC cancellation, you know, it was Amherst started it last year, and then, you know, that one night where Tufts was playing and the season was kind of canceled in the middle of their game was just such a dramatic low point in the 2020 season that, you know, it's nice to have the symmetry of ending on a high note with the NESCAC coming back. But when we're talking about the NESCAC, Kyle, I'm going to kind of flip it over to you. What do you we've talked about Tufts. So we know Tufts is going to be really good. Yep. You know, they have something like 9 All-Americans or something crazy. You know, I think all but one of their All-Americans from last year are coming back. So they're going to be awesome. You know, they're right. The new number one in our rankings that we're going to be posting. Who else are you looking forward to seeing from, you know, just on the field team-wise?
Well, it's funny that you say like schools that we know are playing and aren't playing. We don't know, but I've had specific interaction with Colby over Twitter who were like, no, we're playing. We're fine. Everything's fine. So that's a school to at least look forward to. They're very like into it. You can see Tufts is very into it, posting clips on social and things of that nature. They've not really taken their foot off the accelerator, which I think is probably, you know, a testament to them wanting to play and pushing forward with, you know, alumni and players and coaches and everybody on board to play this season. So I think not only, I know we just talked about Tufts being good, but I think we kind of owe them a little bit for their fortitude as well, pushing through. I really want to see what can happen with this Williams squad. They've got excellent attackmen. They have a strong defense. They have great coaching. They have young assistant coaches that are just crushing it, putting in new stuff, scheming for different teams. Obviously, Wesleyan, I'm always looking forward to seeing the Wesleyan zone, see what I can steal. You know, it's a lot of fun to watch them play. And they've got, you know, they've got Ronan Jacoby stepping in, throwing bombs. You know, and he might not be playing there next year. He might be somewhere else. So that could be fun to watch. You know, I think as far as the rest of it goes, Amherst is an interesting situation. I think we're going to talk about it later. But I don't think we really know what's going on there. We know that there's still a lot of talent there, but I really want to see what Rashad DeVoe does there, and hopefully they get a chance to show that off this season.
Dan, you know, the NESCAC coming back is obviously the biggest. It's funny that the number one team in the country going down in the first week is not the biggest story of this podcast right now. That, you know, I would not have thought that Saturday afternoon after watching Lynchburg take down Salisbury. But, you know, in the past 10 days or so, Centennial also announced they're coming back. The Liberty League is coming back. Dan, as someone who's played Division III lacrosse and is a big D3 fan, you know, just your overall thoughts on the fact that, you know, we were looking at a handful of days ago, our top 20 that we put out, maybe half of the teams not playing. Now we're looking at most of those teams, if not all, are definitively playing a 2021 season. As a fan, how good do you feel?
Man, that is a loaded question. The simple answer is ecstatic, right? I think the biggest thing in Division III lacrosse that makes it so awesome compared to, you know, Division I is some of the parity that exists. And the fact that on any given day, number one may go down just like we saw, right? You know, it can be a team that is as hyped as we've seen in years that if they don't bring it to start the game or they don't bring it for a full 60 minutes, whatever it is, they can end up losing because there's so many good teams in Division III. There's so many guys that are capable of doing things that, you know, you could be seeing on Saturday on the big TVs on ESPN and stuff like that, you know, that, I mean, obviously has been proved a little bit this year as we've seen some of those guys make the jump, but just the parity that exists with all these teams playing and, you know, knowing that their seasons are going to happen so they can start to get practicing and start to develop some chemistry and all that type of stuff, you know, and start to pick up where they have left off. You know, it's just awesome. It's really exciting. And it kind of makes for, I would say, a refreshing feel going into the, you know, each week.
Yeah, when, you know, it's kind of felt like the NESCAC announcement and also the ones in the Centennial and the Liberty and some of the others, you know, it kind of like helped me turn the corner in the sense of like, you know, overall with lacrosse, it's like we're out of like the COVID. We're not out of the woods in terms of the COVID. I'm not trying to imply that, you know, this is a lot of stuff on these student athletes in terms of what they have to do every day, you know, to stay COVID negative and to follow protocols and everything's different. But in terms of for us, it's like, all right, we can watch lacrosse now. And that's not the overarching aspect, is this who is and who isn't. You know, it really makes me in the end feel really bad for the Ivy League that leadership there couldn't, you know, get anything done, you know, despite an offer of a bubble to play, you know, not just lacrosse, but, you know, other sports from what I understand. So great news, you know, kudos to most of all the student athletes in all those affected leagues who have, you know, been doing various levels of practice and preparation and, you know, sacrificing a lot in order for this moment to happen. The coaches and the administration who, you know, I think a lot of people were critical of administrations in these leagues, but, you know, now they're finding a way to get it done, obviously outside of the Ivy League in Division I. RIT is a team that, you know, the Liberty League announcing they are going to be starting up. By the time you listen to this podcast, RIT will have already played a game against Nazareth. They've got some pretty crucial games coming up. St. John Fisher and Cortland, you know, are on the schedule for the coming week. And, you know, this is a team that we're really excited about. So, you know, I think it kind of really firmly puts that, like, the top tier teams in Division III lacrosse are back and we're playing. So this is all good stuff. Want to transition here to the weekend, because obviously the big story of the weekend of the action on the field was Lynchburg took down Salisbury. You know, we were chatting, the three of us, on Slack before this. And I asked, I think, does Lynchburg have any chance of winning this game? Dan, you outlined a scenario in which Lynchburg could do it. And I believe that Coach Kadelka was spying on it, because everything that you said is what exactly happened. What was your main takeaway from Lynchburg beating Salisbury?
Oh, man. So the first thing I say is the hype that had been surrounding Salisbury coming into that game, there was two ways that it plays out. They show up and the other team just rolls over because they're completely intimidated. Or they're not intimidated at all and the hype is actually going to be bad for Salisbury coming into it. And I thought that may be the case. And it's kind of one of those things where once you've beat them once or twice, and once you know that you can, and you've maybe done it, or you've seen older guys on the team do it or something, it's so much easier to then do it again. And so I think that they believed in their locker room before that game that they were going to win that game. I think their staff felt it. I think their players felt it. I think that energy is kind of contagious, you know? And so when their backs were against the wall, that was where they went. Not to a place of, holy crap, you know, what everybody said about them was right. They're, you know, the biggest, fastest, strongest team we've ever played against. We're done, right? And so when their back was against the wall, their mindset changed and went there. And then the other thing I'll say about this is before this game happened and the preseason hype and all that stuff, like, everybody's making a big deal because Salisbury beat Drexel, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's awesome. That's great. But let's not go ahead and put too much into that. Another thing you have to consider here is Lynchburg was beating UVA's starter on starters at halftime. And then they were losing by one goal to High Point at the end of the game, right? And so those are two performances that nobody heard anything about. And so I think Lynchburg's campaign was confident and they weren't scared and they were ready to go into this game with a fight. And Lynchburg came in, or Salisbury came in and landed the first punch. Maybe landed the first two, but then when Lynchburg didn't roll over, they kind of just, Salisbury almost rolled over. It was crazy, you know, as the momentum of that game keeps going. And there's all these sort of hectic plays that keep happening that Lynchburg, you know, is in favor of, and that's the pace they want to play at. Those types of plays just kept happening and happening and happening and falling Lynchburg's way. Even late in the game, Matt, you brought it up right away. There was late in the game, they go down. Salisbury's pressuring, trying to get a turnover, and Lynchburg takes an ill-advised shot. I'm screaming about the shot, like, no, don't take that shot. And then they get the reset, and now they have a full fresh shot clock. You know, and so there were a bunch of plays that were kind of hectic and crazy that went their way that, as a fan, that game was just awesome to watch.
Kyle, what did you see?
Yeah, I think, actually, they were close to rolling over to Salisbury when it was 4-1. And then you saw them actually change defense, focus, and clearing in like one fell swoop. And that's really what got them back in the game. And again, I think we've said this many times, 2021, finally the year of the ride. Do you know what I mean? Like, I feel like I say it every year where I'm just like, ooh, this ride's good. Ooh, this ride's bad. Ooh, this clearing's good. This clearing's bad. It's the art of scoring goals out of turnovers is like, this is what this game was. Right? That actual like move from getting transition into an uneven set and pushing the ball, you know, I could almost like feel myself on the sidelines screaming, put it on them every single time. You know,
can I fill you in on something? I'm going to fill you in on something. I'm going to let a cat out of the bag. This is a Lynchburg secret. To start 6-on-6 possessions in practice, how do you do it? You're a coach. You've done it a million times. How do you start 6-on-6 possessions in practice?
I mean, you transition into 6-on-5 sometimes and you stagger it.
Yeah. You know how Lynchburg does it?
Yeah.
Off a loose ball. Loose ball, move it twice, push that opportunity. And then if there's nothing there, then you get into your offense. And they capitalize on that better than any team in the country. There's not a stat. I'm going to have to get Patrick on it. But I think if we were able to come up with a stat that was tracking goals scored within a certain amount of time off of a ground ball in your own offensive end, Lynchburg would lead the country in it. If you yeah. weren't prepared for that, for them to go and win a scrap on a ground ball, move the ball twice off the ground, and then be ready to slide to somebody on the backside of that, or to be ready to like handle all that scramble, you're going to give up goals. They yeah. do it all the time. They practice it. It's a huge part of their offense.
I think the other thing too is like, and trust me, I'm well aware of the irony of me being the Salisbury defender here. I think that's probably hilarious to everyone that's listening. But the thing, they couldn't hit their shots at all. I mean, they were, you know, I think the stat is, you know, Ferreira, Bramwell, and Maroney took 36 shots and the rest of the team took 11. And those weren't bad shots per se. A lot of them went over. A lot of them Patrick Moore didn't even see, but the ones that he did see, he still made 10 saves. So I think his performance was integral. Again, fixing their clear in the first half was, and especially the first quarter, was not good. I think they missed at least three or four easy passes to just clear the ball. And they actually have a great press, a ride breaker where they put guys on both sides, which is what I've been screaming for D1 teams to do, because D1 teams are just scared to put a guy near the box for some reason. They think he's just going to get lit up. But in D3, it's the same concern with these two teams in particular, because the athleticism is there and it matches, if not, you know, I mean, Brad Apgar's like what, 6'11"?
Yeah. How tall is he? Something like that.
It's scary. Like there, the shot of the game, the angle the game was shot at, I turned it on and the first thing I saw was Lynchburg, like clearing midi come down. And then I saw Apgar switch on him. And I've never seen a dude pass the ball faster in my life. Like he just saw like feet. All I saw was feet and stick. And I was like, I'm not even playing and I'm scared. Like what's happening? And he moved it on. But I think, you know, a lot of this game is like you were saying, Dan, a lot of great Lynchburg adjustments, right? But we're also saw a lot of Salisbury mistakes and they couldn't do what they usually do, which is build on that early lead they get, you know, like, coming back against Salisbury is not easy. Like, I'm not trying to take credit away from Lynchburg at all. I think, if anything, it's more remarkable they came back from 4-1 down. Like, that's the most, to me, that's the most remarkable thing about the game. Forget the at the end, they executed on, you know, hustle plays and out-hustled for ground balls and made key, like, jumps to force passes that went out of bounds. I mean, that's the thing. Like you're attacking the spacing and Lynchburg does such a good job of that, more so than I thought that they were capable of. So, I mean, you know, it was a little surprising to me, especially given the first 20 minutes or so of the game, how it played out.
I will come to Salisbury's defense with a couple things. I don't want to be the, you know, solely attacking them. I do think that they obviously have such a high ceiling for this season, and losing one game early in the season is not a deal breaker. Couple things for them. Like, they're not going to shoot 2 of 18 with their midfield in most of the games they play this season, right? That's just not going to happen. As they get, you know, that may even be an early season thing, right? They're just sprayed all these shots wide. They need to continue to get some reps by midseason. They're not shooting 2 of 18 with their midfield, right? So that's one thing. The other thing I'll say is defensively, one of their, I would say, most integral pieces, they're one of their most key guys, Drew Borkowitz, didn't play at all. Think he's dealing with something. I'm sure it's, you know, a minor thing, but he's their organizer, and so they have all these dudes that can go out and pressure and play your hands and make you uncomfortable, but eventually one of those things breaks down and what you need is the guy out there to be like, yo, get your D-meaties down and get them into spots and, you know, do the organizing. And that's where he comes in and helps. And I think that, you know, I don't think that he makes the biggest difference in the game. I'm not saying that they win that game if he plays. But he definitely would help erase one goal, two goals maybe, by just getting the guys more organized and helping to eliminate some of those breakdowns that we did see with the defense.
And no Malanfi either at the X. So it's a huge piece for them.
Yeah, I mean, if they win 70% of faceoffs, that game is the other way. Yeah. Like, I think that's no doubt. Malanfi should be back this weekend, you know, according to Salisbury Sports Information Department. So that's good news for the Seagulls. And in terms of preseason hype, I was the hype man in terms of putting up a story about how amazing Salisbury is days before their first game, which, I mean, again, a few years ago, remember we saw them almost lose to Barry and we roasted them on the podcast. And then I think they probably won it that year. That might have been a year they lost to Wesleyan in the final. But, you know, so things will change. We didn't mention what I think is the, you know, one of the biggest pieces in this, and that's Tyler Gallagher, the Lynchburg defender. And Dan, you mentioned those preseason scrimmages. He defended Matt Moore against Virginia. He defended Asher Nolting against High Point in preseason scrimmages. And he did well against both of them, you know, at least from what I've heard secondhand. So I think that should tell you, you know, how big of a difference maker he is. You know, he was mostly on Cross Ferreira during this game, but he can take anyone in Division III and kind of erase that matchup. And that's a luxury that Lynchburg has that not a lot of teams can do. You know, Kudelka was pretty clear that he thinks he's the best defenseman in Division III lacrosse right now. So, you know, that's not a bad chip to have on your side. And just, you know, the offense is, I don't know if there's that like kind of alpha on the Lynchburg offense, but there's going to be like just several guys who chip in a few points. And that's going to be the way that Lynchburg is going to win games this year. You know, I don't think they're going to have that Austin Stewart, like, you know, guy who has a million points, but they're going to have several guys who are, you know, getting 2 or 3 points in a game. And, you know, that's kind of one of the ways you beat Salisbury.
Yep. They followed the slide really well offensively. Mm-hmm. Lynchburg was very excellent at kind of not running off of picks necessarily, but moving the ball and kind of challenging, waiting for the defender to come out, especially when there was that Salisbury was in like kind of a hybrid zone in the broken situation sometimes. And the two guys on the crease kind of swapped a couple times and got wide open looks for super key goals late in the game.
Moving on to some of the other action in Division III. And I think a lot of this stuff is up your alley, Dan. You know, a lot of good South action that happened this weekend. The first thing that I want to ask you about is Cabrini. Should we worry about how good Cabrini can be? You know, I think we said 2 weeks ago that they are the definitive number four team in the country. They barely beat Southern Virginia this weekend. Should we be worried about Cabrini?
So here's the thing with Southern Virginia, because that's what this is about. I think it's way more about Southern Virginia than it is about Cabrini. And people are going to be crazy, but it's true. Southern Virginia is a team that if you aren't prepared to hold the ball against or to have disciplined possessions against, they will make you pay, because they are awesome in transition and they are even better on offense. And so if you allow them the possessions that they need, they will score on you. No matter what defense you are playing, no matter who you are, Southern Virginia can score on you. And that's what happened. I think Cabrini just saw that it was Southern Virginia. I think they saw some of their scores. I think they saw some things and just assumed some things that were not true. And yes, they've lost already twice by 10 goals to CNU and Lynchburg. But if you go back and look at those box scores, they're 6-6 at halftime. They're 7-7 at points. They're close games. And then the wheels fall off. And so Southern Virginia, obviously, like, I'm not sitting here telling you that they should be ranked. I'm not sitting here telling you they're one of the best teams in the country. But they are a team that if you think you're going to sleepwalk through, they're going to make you pay. Because they are awesome on offense. They care a whole lot. They have a great coach who knows exactly what he's doing. He's been around the block. And so they're a team that if you try and sleepwalk through, they're going to make you pay. And I think that's what we saw more so than we saw a not great Cabrini team. I think that they're still awesome. I think they're going to be great on offense. You know, maybe the Southern Virginia offense did expose some things for them defensively, but those are things that early in the season you learn from. They don't end up plaguing you the entire season, right? If you're a good team, good coach, right, they're going to make those adjustments. So I think it's more about Southern Virginia is a lot better than a whole lot of people think than it is about Cabrini wasn't so great.
Kyle, there's teams that aren't necessarily like, and this is going to come out, I know this is going to come out the wrong way, but there's teams that aren't necessarily like good. You know, they don't have a lot of wins. They don't have a lot of success, you know, in those metrics, but they are very difficult to prepare for.
Right.
What makes a team like that, in your opinion?
Work ethic is the first thing. So when I was coaching, my team was, we had like very little talent, right? Especially my last gig. And one of the things that I always push forward is our conditioning is the most important thing, because we're not going to beat anyone with our ball skills. So we're going to beat them with our feet and our schemes. And if you learn those things and you commit to those things, those are the things that will lead to goals. They will lead to stops, and that's where you start. I think that's a starting point for any team that isn't rich with talent. You know, I think the real coaching comes after that, to be honest with you. A lot of that is drill sergeanting. You know, like, I mean, I think I've told this story in the podcast before. We had a preseason first practice, and kids just wasn't feeling it. Effort wasn't there. And I just blew the whistle, and we were inside. We were in the gym, and I grabbed the trash can and just dragged it to the middle of the floor. And I said, take your gear off and get on the line. And everyone kind of fell. And I was like, why are you upset? You need this more than you need what you were doing before, because you need to be able to run before you can actually play. And none of you are prepared to do any of this right now because you're not ready. You're not in shape. So we're going to get in shape, and then we're going to do that. You know, I think now in these kind of COVID times, you don't have the luxury of that. And hopefully your team knew that and was already in shape. There's not enough time to really prep unless they're doing their own work. And I think you're going to see a lot of these kind of close results of teams that like really came together over this time period and developed like a new level of work ethic. And I think that's probably what Dan's alluding to here, right? I mean, that's that if you have that belief, if you have that athleticism, the speed, the power, the will, then the other stuff kind of comes at certain levels and certain times in games and against certain opponents that are probably like, yeah, man, we're going to roll over this team. It's going to be like 20-1. I'm going to get a hat trick. Like, as soon as you go into a game like that, you have to be prepared to deal with the consequences of you thinking like that. And I think that's probably, you know, if you're cock of the walk and you're walking into a game against a team that you perennially beat historically, you know, by 5, 10, 12, 15 goals, you are vulnerable. And I think you're more vulnerable now than you've ever been, personally.
Dan Kaplan and I are pondering a road trip over to Salisbury in a few weeks, or I guess about 10 days or so. They're playing on a Friday afternoon against Cabrini. So that's definitely one to watch kind of in the short term here. We'll record again before that game is played. Stevenson is a team, the next team to kind of talk about. You know, they had a win this weekend against Stevens. We didn't know what to do with them in the preseason. Did you have any clarity on how you feel about Stevenson going forward, Dan?
Yeah, I have him higher. So I did a draft last night, putting together like a, you know, week one top 20. I have them significantly higher than I had them originally based on what I did see. They're much better defensively this year in game one than they have been in early season in the past. Early season Stevenson defenses the last couple years have been chickens with their heads cut off, running all over the place, sliding to people that don't need slides, not sliding to people when they do, you know, recovering poorly, short stick D mids, taking terrible approaches. I'm trying not to chuckle right now because I think back to doing some game plan type stuff when I was coaching at York, and I can think of it, really recall so many of these horrible short stick D midi approaches where they're flying out. And, you know, they're trying to close out and will literally like jump and dive and all over the place because they think that, you know, if you hitch them, you're just right by them. And so all of those types of things that have plagued them early in the years in the past, they're kind of ahead of those. And so if they can continue to build on that and be a much better defense, you know, towards the end of the year than they've been on in years past, I think that'll be really important for them. And I think the fact that the first thing that I talked about with Stevenson was their defense, not their offense, means that this is a different team for them than they've had in the past. You know, it's not like I thought that their offense was stalling or offense was, you know, not very great. They have an identity, that's for sure. They know exactly what they're doing on each possession. That's giving the ball to Ryan Coleman or Josh Brandon and letting them work short stick D-middies on the wing. Like, they have an identity. They know what their offense is. They do a good job in it. But I think the fact that Stevenson's defense is so much farther along at this point in the season than they have been in years past is a really, really, really good indicator for them.
Christopher Newport is a team that, you know, I feel like we've been pretty high on them in preseason. And I think for the past few years, I think we've seen what they're building. That kind of manifested itself in their opener this weekend against Roanoke, 17-6 win. How high is this Christopher Newport season? High is this Christopher Newport ceiling?
I will say, according to my Twitter DMs, there is no ceiling. thank you, Dan, for that, for just telling people they're open now. I regretted opening them again. I think, you know, offensively and organizationally, they're a compelling team to watch. I think they're going to be top 10 for the whole season. And I think that translates to, you know, hopefully success and making the postseason and getting a good matchup and making it through further rounds.
I do think that they are a pretty complete team. I have a lot of confidence in them. I think that they are, you know, like I said, they're very complete. They're good on offense. They're good on defense. They're good in the middle of the field. The area that makes them, if I were to say that they were lacking a piece, is they kind of stink facing off right now. They need to address that. That was the biggest thing, not necessarily against Roanoke, but against Hampton Sydney, they struggled there, right? And if they're going to be one of those best teams in the country, they're going to have to find a way to at least neutralize the other best Fogos in the country. In years past, they've done a really good job with Phoenix Hines, their LSM. They'll put him on there because they've been struggling with this for a bit now. It's been something that's plagued them over the last couple of years. So they've been around the block with trying different things to address it and all that type of stuff. And so one of the things that they use is Phoenix Hines. I remember, if I recall correctly, I think it was 2018 or 2019. He was right at the top of the country in calls turnovers because they do this, and they let him go to work on other Fogos once they pick the ball up. And so that's something that you're going to win some games off of. You're going to cause some trouble, but that's better as a complement to having something that's good to go there. Better as a plan B, better as a sub, better as, you know, something that's kind of an adjustment. If you're relying on that, you may be in trouble there. And so if they can adjust that, I would say that his ceiling potentially is as high as, you know, unlimited. But until they do, I think that you're going to see them kind of capped at a top 10 team, you know, maybe gets a 7 or something if they have a big win. But I don't see them beating any of the top, you know, 5 teams in the country as it is right now, which stinks to say because they're my pick. But
well, we still haven't seen how the new rules have completely played out. You know, I don't think it's, you know, from the sample size we've seen, people who were expecting every game to be 50-50 were just, you know, that was never going to be the case. You know, like a good face-off guy is still a good face-off guy. And these guys have been practicing with the rules, and there's going to be, you know, guys who are better than others. But like, I don't know, not having great face-offs isn't necessarily a death sentence.
Yeah.
But I think you're kind of right in the sense of like, it is a significant hurdle to get to that, like, you know, the 5 teams who are actually in the title mix discussion. That's a big, big, big hurdle to get over if you're not excelling at the faceoff X.
It's almost like changing the rules on the faceoff every season is pointless. Right?
Really?
Yeah, almost.
have you, like, let's delve into that just a little bit. Have you seen a significant, like, byproduct of these?
Cheating?
Yeah,
I think that, and it's, I think it's harder for the ref. Because it's harder to spot, and the way they're like setting guys up, I think that when you change rules, the first group of people you have to, and you know, indoctrinate into those rules isn't the players, it's the refs. So if you have some sort of inconsistency there, it's going to show out. Like if you're watching faceoffs on camera, I think there have been a couple D1 games where you've been able to see kind of an over the top or side view. Or like that 3-quarter angle that like made it look like literally everyone was cheating, because I think they probably were in a certain game. I'm not going to say which one. But the way that that's officiated, I think, is, you know, it takes time to adjust to officiating a rule change that's that drastic and occurs that often every game, right? So if you're looking at a 30-goal game, how many faceoffs is that? It's at least 34, right? I mean, we're looking at how all of these things play out. I think the adjustment has been quicker, but I do think with facing off, as with most things, there's ways to kind of get around, you know, the new rule or exploit the new rule before anyone else. But I don't think that's been super plentiful or impactful yet. I think there we're on our road to a to something where we've changed it too much and now like we can't go back. But I don't know if we're there yet. We're just in the car waiting. Right?
The well it's also the like with the rule with the adjudication of the rules, which is a word that like we use in lacrosse way too much, adjudication. Mm-hmm. But the with the adjudication of the rules, the new changes combined with COVID was just like not a good way to start this.
Right.
You know, with the way that they have to step back before the actual face off and they're 6 feet away, that just kind of is opening the door to more of this cheating. Because it's like, I mean, like, I don't know, it's just human nature. Like, are you going to go back, walk back again and come back and walk back again and come back? Like, what are you going to do? So that wasn't like, that has not been a good, like, you know, it's not the best foot forward for the new rules. But again, like, if there's people who were like, oh, this is going to be the like thing that makes like a dominant face-off specialist not like an integral part of the game. Like, no, I don't think there's still some really great face-off guys who have trained and put in the work who are going to dominate games. And like, it's not just something that as a coach, you can be like, oh, we're going to roll the ball out and, you know, we're going to get half of them and they're going to get half of them and we'll figure it out. Like, if that's your attitude to this, then, and I'm not saying that's the Christopher Newport attitude whatsoever, but if that is your attitude toward this, then you are in for a rude awakening.
Yeah. If you're bad at face-offs, you're still bad at face-offs. I think is the thing we learned. Yeah. If you're not good at it, you're not going to be any better at it.
Maybe Hampton Sydney's just really, really good at facing off. We have to see.
Yeah. Right? Yep.
They did. That discrepancy was 26-4 in that game, though. So Hampton Sydney won 26 faceoffs. CNU won 4. But the fact that they were able to, you know, come up with that gap and still win the way they did is says something about the rest of the pieces on that team.
Looking a little bit broader, you know, there's you know, going to be a head coaching job that is pretty significant opening up in Division III lacrosse, and that's Washington College. You know, I didn't realize this was coming, but Coach Shirk, you know, announced that, you know, he's going to retire from his role at Washington College and take a new role where he's going to be moving on. You know, he'll be there this season, but that's a pretty significant, you know, head coaching job, you know, for a team that has a lot of tradition. It's in, I would say, a very desirable area in terms of geographical in where you want to be able to recruit top talent. And there's a lot going for, you know, the institution at large. Dan, this, I guess just, well, I'll put it like that, you know, like how much of like a top tier job is Washington College?
Well, I would say it's one of those schools that with the right coach, it can be as top tier perennially as you can imagine, as every other school that, you know, does that consistently year after year after year.
I'll go the opposite way. I don't know like what Washington College wants to do. You know, mm-hmm. what do they want to do with this program? What do they want to do with athletics? I think that's the first question we have to ask every single college now. When we're looking at a coaching search, it's not a given that everybody's gonna invest money into a program anymore. You know, I think that's one of the side effects of this whole COVID situation. The student attrition is real, regardless of being an athlete. It's actually less impactful for athletes, but it's still something to consider, something to take into account when you're looking at, you know, who's this school's kind of dream hire. I mean, Matt, we were talking about it before, but I'll let Matt throw out the dream hire for Washington College, which if you paid attention is a no-brainer, right?
Yeah, Rick Soule.
Yeah.
Like, I would love to see Rick Soule at Washington College. You know, he's a legend there. He obviously has tremendous coaching experience, you know, most recently at Navy, and he's been doing a lot of, you know, teaching and stuff outside, you know, now that he's not at Navy. The one thing that, like, you know, and I think it would be a great fit for Rick Soule. The one thing that, like, I feel like Rick maybe doesn't get the credit for his like one-on-one and small group development ability in terms of, you know, and that's why, you know, I think that like he can take a single player and really make them a lot better. You know, I think he's a very good, like, you know, technician coach in terms of being able to find a guy and find what is that thing that's going to make him 25% better. You know, I think that it's, you know, he's at a point in his career where Washington College can be a place where he, you know, maybe retires at or, you know, a place that he, there's got to be, you know, at least some charm to the fact of going back to your alma mater and seeing what you can do, particularly a team that, like, you know, I don't think any of us are going to, like, say that, like, oh, he's going to come and make them a national championship contender. I think he can come and make them a consistently very good team and hope for the right group that comes in and make a run. But that's a really, really desirable thing. And, you know, I haven't, Dan, I didn't know about this Washington College hire until 2 hours ago when you told me that, you know, the job was open. So I haven't talked to Rick Soule or anyone close to that program about it. But, you know, hey, I think that's definitely the natural, that's definitely a name that at least has to be in the mix. And he should get a phone call and at least give his input on who should be at that position. But there's also the other angle, and that's, you know, do you hire one of these, you know, guys who's been, who's a young, promising assistant coach who's been, you know, grinding on the recruiting trail, who knows the like teams in Division III lacrosse, who knows the personnel, who can be there for a significant amount of time and build it into something, you know, very, very big. I think that's a riskier option, but also maybe a higher ceiling. And maybe you find that guy that's going to be the 25-year head coach there, who does a lot of special things. So, Kyle, you're definitely right in terms of what are their goals. And post-COVID, I don't think it's fair for any of us to assume that we know what a team's goals are. I'll use, like, you know, you've seen some teams like Quinnipiac is a team in D1 that, like, I heard so many people talking about how awesome of a job that was. They just lost to St. Bonaventure this week. I don't know if it's just, you know, this is just going to be an off year for them, but it definitely leads to believe that, like, what are the resources that they're giving and what's the investment that's being made in that program? So things change, you know, different people come in terms of administration and academic leadership and athletics leadership that, you know, it's definitely one of those things where, like, I want to explore what the goals are for Washington College and kind of make up my mind of who the best hire is there. But my early, I'm throwing my hat in the ring early for Rick Soule there.
Yep. 100% agree.
One thing that seems like it's going to be a recurring segment on this podcast for us is the D3 and D1, you know, spotlight. You know, I feel like we need, like, a little bit of, like, a
drop. Intro. We need a drop, yeah, right there.
We need a drop.
Some sort of tune.
So I think, you know, since we've recorded this podcast, we've seen Mitch Wyckoff take a starting role on the Syracuse defense, and it seems to have made a significant positive impact on that team. But I think the biggest revelation has been at Vermont with Michael McCormick and what he's been able to do on that Vermont offense. This offense, and I actually just happened to have talked to Coach Fifes yesterday and Thomas McConvey on the Vermont offense this morning. They're explosive, and they can do a lot of dangerous things. Kyle, what has McCormick added to it?
I think what he does is he gives them kind of the playmaker. I know that he's going viral for his shooting, but the thing about playmakers is you can set it up with your feet or you can set it up with your shot, right? And what he does is he does both. Which I think is, you know, very rare. I think he's not, use the word explosive for the potential for the offense. I don't think he in particular is explosive, but I think his ability to set things up and see shooting lanes and distribute the ball after a run out or a defender charging him is exceptional. And I think that frees up, you know, guys like Liam Limoges on the inside to do work that they've been doing, you know, successfully for many seasons. I think Vermont is a fun team. They've kind of always been fun. I had the pleasure of going up to, Burlington's beautiful. I mean, actually right now, cause it's probably around like 50 out there cause it's 60 something here. So you just take off like 15. But just cause it's so far north doesn't mean it's like not a great place to play college lacrosse. It's incredible. It's cold, but once it warms up, man, it's a beautiful campus. They have an amazing setup there. It's very old school. They have this huge stone building they do a lot of their practice in, and then it kind of overlooks this beautiful field with you can fill up the bleachers. It's a great place to play. I think it's one of those things where McCormick came from Middlebury, right? And he comes into this team, and I had this rant earlier, and I'm going to rant it on the podcast because it needs to be public. If you are a program that gets an Impact D3 transfer, why are you not immediately emailing everyone in this podcast? Because like we want to talk about you constantly. Are you using subterfuge to surprise people with your D3 players? Like, you don't need to do that. You know, it's more valuable to get the story and the feedback from, you know, putting it out there to the public than it is to hide it and try and win games with your magical D3 player, which they are magical. So, you know, with McCormick, I think he got that national stage with that Syracuse game and blew up, and rightly so. So I think they're definitely a team to watch. As far as like wins go right now, they're not racking them, but I think, you know, it's early and I think they're only going to get better offensively. I think defensively, you know, not to pick on certain positions, but you give the bad with the good. I think, you know, the goaltending against Syracuse was a little rough. And I think they kind of let up too many of those low wing shots that are kind of hard for goalies to see in the dome. I'm not, you know, knocking Syracuse or their efforts. I think, you know, if you had Washuda back, I think the Vermont team would have maybe pulled an upset there. You know, I think it's definitely one of those things where you went from a top, you know, All-American candidate goalie to breaking in a new goalie, and it's very early. And I think, again, lots of room to develop. There's no shade being thrown here, but I think if we're talking about potential of programs to succeed this season, you know, it's Vermont, and it's built kind of on the back of the McCormick transfer, which I think is amazing and a great story.
Yeah, so the thing with McCormick is his blow up, I feel like, is kind of a long time coming. Had he transferred to Vermont from Tufts or from Wesleyan or something, that, you know, a school that wasn't Middlebury, who wasn't as good, you know, in their conference and nationally, he would have been one of the like most talked about transfers of all of them, I think, which is really cool. So his glow up, I feel like, is kind of, you know, a long time coming. So that's awesome for him. I feel like the next one that we're going to get to watch, do you guys know who I'm thinking of?
I don't.
Well, someone's going to have to pronounce his last name for me.
Lestava.
Lestava.
That. I think he's next. So he's getting good.
Klastowa.
Yeah, I'm not even going to try. Everybody knows what I'm talking about at this point. But yeah, he's getting some good burn. He's got a few points. I think he's the next to kind of either like make somebody fall down or hit some sort of ridiculous shot or something. But he's next to go viral on this, like, holy crap, D3 players are actually good enough to play with us, you know, play D1, you know, whatever that narrative is, so to speak. Right. But I think he's next to jump in line there.
Yeah, Lestava, he's getting a lot of minutes. And like, I'm pretty sure that he scored Fairfield's first goal this year, or one of their early goals, and kind of got a lot more attention from the opposing defense after that. You know, the thing that I think is impressive about both of them, you know, McCormick and Lestava can be a chameleon. You know, like, he can play multiple spots. He did play multiple spots when he was at Bates, depending on, you know, their personnel that they needed him. You know, he was carrying in some years, he wasn't in other years. McCormick, like Kyle said, like, his shot is just awesome. Like, he stretches it 20 yards, and that opens up a lot of stuff for Vermont inside, where they have these awesome Canadian finishers. But, you know, he's a coach's kid. He's George McCormick's son from Williams. And, you know, Chris Fifes, the Vermont coach, was talking about how, like, yeah, he's a shooter, but we can put him anywhere on the field too. So when people start to get film, you know, I think his role might shift and you might see him be able to do some other stuff. So it's like, I don't know, it just really shows the value of, like, you know, you can't be a one-trick pony, you know. And maybe that's a D3 thing in terms of, like, you know, whether it's roster sizes being smaller or just, like, you know, having to kind of do a little bit more, where, like, you know, a coach maybe isn't recruiting, like, I'm going to recruit you to do this one role, and that's what you're going to do for 4 years. But, you know, I think what you're seeing from both of these guys is an ability to change an offense in different ways.
Yeah, I think you get more opportunities to try different spots at D3. Just like my own personal experience, like, I played on a rough team and I played every position except goalie, you know, and that's kind of, it made me better and made me understand things better as the games happened. And then when I became a coach, I kind of was able to draw upon those. And I think that actually happens with more players than you think. Like, even Wyckoff's not playing LSM, man. He's down low you know, throwing slaps on guys trying to beat him at GLE, and they're not beating him, and they're kind of like surprised, and like you shouldn't be, because good defense individually translates no matter where you are in the field. I think situationally people get super far into that as like a detail oriented thing. But if you can play defense one-on-one and you can make a guy go where he doesn't want to go, then you're a good defender. It doesn't really matter where you are on the field if you have that skill, and Wyckoff has that skill. So, you know, I think you're going to see a lot of guys, if there are, you know, this opportunity is pretty unique in terms of everyone having that extra year. But I think it's the trickle down effect is you're going to see more D3 guys. My son, Kevin Rogers, my beautiful son, doing great things at High Point, man. I love watching High Point just to watch Kevin Rogers. Fact. Like, the trickle down effect of that is it's because I'm a D3 guy, but it's also because like the success of that entire division is everyone's success that loves it, which is why like we do this podcast, why this podcast is a huge reach, huge downloads, and like everybody kind of listens to it. I know you don't want to hear that. Dan, I just saw your face. I know you don't want to hear that, but like it happens. Like the outreach is huge and the community is bigger than pretty much any other lacrosse community. They're just not as loud. And that's fine. Like that's what you have people like me for, to be loud for you. And I'm happy to do it. It's the most fun I have all week.
Next week for this segment, we need to plan out some time, like we were talking about, and do a who the Division Ones have missed because coronavirus wasn't a thing.
Okay. We could do that.
I love it.
Who over the past several years, like if they had the extra year, would have made the jump? Yeah. Is that what you're saying? Yeah.
Exactly. Not even just made it, but gone and then done as well, if not better, than Kevin Rogers. I got a couple in my brain that are obvious, and then I got a couple in there that may not be so obvious that I think that had they been given the opportunity, they would have gone to that stage and done some unbelievable things.
We should use Kevin Rogers as our measurement. So he's like a plus one Kevin Rogers, or like a Kevin Rogers minus one, you know, but, in terms of impact.
Yeah.
They have 4 Rogers points.
Yeah. What's the over-unders on the Rogers effect?
Yeah.
The last thing I want to talk about on this podcast, you know, we're getting near an hour here, an hour of goodness. The Division II landscape, you know, still the NE10 hasn't played yet. And, you know, the number one or number two team in the nation preseason, depending on who you ask, Tampa, they have not played yet. So there's a lot of like the very top end that's still kind of like in preseason mode, so to speak, for Division II. But there's been a lot of games, particularly in the D2 South. And there was a game this past weekend that I think two of the biggest storylines in D2 collided in one game. That is, Lenoir Ryan is a legitimate title contender. And two, Limestone is just, I mean, this is just not their year. This is just COVID hit them pretty significantly in the sense of, you know, transfers out of the program, and they lost a lot because of that. But Limestone just kind of doesn't have it this year. And, you know, it might be the year that, you know, I know they had a down year a few years ago, but, you know, you never want to like completely say that like Limestone isn't going to come back and be a factor in the South NCAA tournament. But it feels like there's enough really good teams in the South, combined with the fact that Limestone's down, that maybe this is the year that they're just not kind of that, you know, May factor. So Kyle, what's the ceiling on Lenoir Ryan? First of all,
I love Lenoir Ryan. They're fun to watch. Their offense, they do things that are a little careless for my taste. They have a little bit of the Illinois Wesleyan about them. When they're in transition, they're always pushing, which is great, but like maybe not always. They don't care. It's just straight up. This year, I think the thing that has stood out for me, they've got Dickinson back, Moffitt back, and their goaltender, Noah Johnson. But the guy that I really like watching is Bryce Reese, who's a midfielder, sophomore from Mount Laurel, New Jersey. He had a move against the Belmont Abbey defender that I feel like put the Belmont Abbey defender into another dimension. Like he just went, it's almost like watching one of those crossover videos on like Instagram for like basketball guys doing crossovers and games, and like the guy flies off the screen. I mean, if the angle wasn't being shot from space, you would have seen the guy fly off the screen. Unfortunately, you know, the game angle for that was not great, but you still got to see a guy like Reese throw like a crazy dodge and change direction and score low to high, which, you know, is the dream shot in lacrosse, right? If you're an offensive player, you're like, ooh, I'm gonna smoke this guy, make him fall, and then stick this. And you go low to high, and it looks pretty and all of that. And it's great. But I think the work ethic of this team is the thing that I really want to focus on. Against Belmont Abbey, a team that is very good, they've kind of struggled a little bit, sort of like Limestone early on in the season. But Lemon Ryan was able to just stay in the game. Belmont Abbey turned up their physicality, and Lemon Ryan just soaked it and started just hammering goals in to win that game. So that, for me, was the best D2 game I've seen all season, especially since one of the other ones I saw was Wingate versus Limestone, which was atrocious if you're a Limestone fan. And I think the stat that was given in the game is that was the first loss in for Limestone at home in 5 years. Which is, the commentator said that during the game. I was like, how is that possible? How's that possible? And they were only able, Limestone was only able to score 3 goals. Now that's a lot of credit to Wingate. Wingate is very improved. I think they're probably the Lemoir Ryan of this season. If we're talking about Lemoir Ryan from last season. And I think they're a team to watch, man. They're very well organized. But in terms of Lemoir Ryan being a contender, I think they're in the conversation. I think they're a top three team right now.
And it's, you know, Lenore Ryan, like, I don't see them having a game that they're going to be really tested
right
until they play Wingate, which is going to be April 7th, you know, at least tentatively right now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they're going to be a team. They have one loss technically, but that was to a Mercer game, you know, yeah, a cross divisional game. But so they're 3-0 in Division Two. You know, the Belmont Abbey game was close, and they had a close game against North Greenville. I'm not, you know, first game of the year, I'm not entirely certain what was up with that. There's always,
they didn't have all their personnel for that game, actually.
They didn't have all their personnel.
They didn't have everybody playing in that game. They had several people out with protocol. So
I mean, I think you're looking at, you know, April 7th, Lenore Ryan Wingate is kind of that, like, all right, which of these D2 South teams is, like, you know, going somewhere in May. The other one is just going to be very good, but just not, you know, quite to that elite level. I mean, obviously we haven't seen Tampa yet to see, you know, what they're going to be doing. And Wingate is coached by Tim Boyle. I did a podcast a few years ago with him, and, you know, they kind of made a run a few years ago after Boyle got on board coaching that team. You know, he was national championship coach at Dowling when that program existed. So, you know, two teams, very well coached, incredibly high ceilings, really going to be fun to watch. But, you know, obviously, I think everyone's, you know, looking forward to the NE10 to start there. You know, some of those northern teams and Tampa, obviously, there's a lot of buzz about Tampa. And they've got, like every year, they got a lot of transfers. But maybe this is their, in addition to the transfers, just the deepest team that they've ever had, which has been maybe where they've struggled, where they've had a lot of these, like, you know, their top guys are really good, but you're not necessarily sure who the next guy up is.
Right.
So, a lot of interesting stuff happening there. But yeah, this is a big week. This was a huge week in kind of our world here, you know, with the NESCAC, with Salisbury falling, with more and more games happening. You know, the weekend doesn't look like there's many games that are, like, you know, I'm definitely, like, run into the live stream to watch. But, you know, something's going to come up. A lot of weird stuff happens in COVID days. So definitely keep an eye on the D3 scoreboard this weekend.
Absolutely.
All right, guys, we're back. The boys are back in town, and we're ready to roll. So thanks, everyone, for listening. Make sure you're following all of us on Twitter. Dan, can you give a shout-out to your Twitter account?
DKaplan46.
And, yep, I'm at DKyleDevitt.
I'm at Matt Kinnear. We're going to – if you're listening to this, be sure to check out our updated rankings. You know, definitely – make a comment and like this on whatever podcast service that you're using, so that we can, you know, the more numbers we get, the more we're gonna put into it, and maybe we'll do more and more and more. So thanks a lot, and keep living the D3 life.
Play the song, play the tune,
play my song again.